This is Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Arunsa on Classic 1027.
Good morning. It's just gone 4 minutes after seven, and you're listening to Classic Business Breakfast with myself, Nastasia Arunsa, and Arabile Gumede is in studio with us.
Good morning, Tasha. I hope you've had a good week. I know we've spent most of it together, haven't we?
It's been a good, busy news week, especially yesterday afternoon with all the results and some good, some very horrible.
Yeah. It goes bad, it goes really bad, doesn't it? A jam-packed show as well today. Another one where we talk about a lot of things that happened. Of course, yesterday, Lesetja Ganyaho and the MPC decided to keep rates on hold. But also, the big announcement today, perhaps not as much focus as we usually have on things like the ratings agencies, but S&P, formerly called Standard & Poor's, will be having their announcement of South Africa's credit rating as well this evening. It should come out around 4 p.m. New York time, which is probably plus minus 10 p.m. South African time as well.
That's right. And then we have a really big interview with Public Enterprises Minister Pravin Gordhan this morning. His main focus probably for the next few months is recapturing the state-owned entities and getting them back on the right foot. We've seen some sweeping changes on various SOE boards, so we'll have a full in-depth conversation with the minister.
It's been a big thing for particularly the EFF, but I think the ANC has also made it some of its own mandate. Black-owned bank in South Africa, that's certainly one thing that they have rooted for quite some time. We'll talk about a company that is really keen on attempting to build a black-owned bank, and it says one brick at a time. We'll speak to Warren Wheatley, who's the executive director of Lebashe Financial Services.
Right, and then we have a fun conversation on investing in classic cars. Yeah. Lots of car aficionados tend to go to various events. So one that I can think of right now is the Neisner Motor Show. So we'll speak to Leon Strumper, who is from Sanlam Private Wealth, about what exactly makes a car investable.
Yeah, certainly an interesting one. The An Mahindra investing in a huge plant as well down in KZN. We'll get all of that and more coming up in just a bit. But let's kick off your Friday edition of Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
This is Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Arunsa on Classic 1027.
These market indicators are brought to you by FNB, bringing you the 48-hour cash accelerator. Visit fnb.co.za for more info. Asian stocks are tracking lower after Trump cancels the North Korea summit. The Greater China markets eased in the morning with Hong Kong's Hang Seng slipping 0.5%. On the mainland, the Shanghai composite edged down a quarter of a percent. And then the Japan's Nikkei raised early losses to advance 0.1%, backing the broader decline that we're seeing in the region. Over on the U.S. front, Dow Jones closed 75 points lower to finish the closing bell, and the S&P 500 shed 0.2%, closed just over 2,700 points, and the Nasdaq composite finished largely unchanged, seeing losses in Facebook, Intel, and gains in Netflix and Adobe. And the FTSE 100 just lastly down 0.9% yesterday. These market indicators were brought to you by FNB. Get a great rate and quick access to your investment. T's and C's apply.
This is Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Arunsa on Classic 1027.
Time now for a quick look at how the markets are performing. In studio, we're joined by Gary Boyson, portfolio manager at Rand Swiss. Gary, yesterday the JSE closing a little lower, really not latching on to any particular gains from earnings of any sort. But today's movement might pretty much be driven by results as well. But is there anything of substance?
Well, I think, yeah, certainly we saw some big moves on individual counters based on results. I mean, we had a lot of results out yesterday. We obviously had the Massmart news, that stock falling, you know, I think it was 18% at the end.
Yeah.
We had Mediclinic also down fairly heavily after reporting impairments to its Switzerland business. We had, what else did we have yesterday?
We had
Fushini down as well. We also on the back of weaker sales forecasts, because a lot of the numbers that we're seeing are I suppose, indicative of a tough time in South Africa. But yeah. I think what really spooked the market on a lot of the results was the forward-looking statements as well.
Yeah.
We also had Famous Brands out yesterday. They didn't look too bad, but again, that Gourmet Burger Kitchen acquisition really hurting them in the UK. I didn't think it was too bad. The stock actually finished marginally positive. But you know, what I think really sent the market lower towards the end was the announcement from Donald Trump that he'd be cancelling discussions with North Korea. And that's certainly, we've had a difficult week for emerging markets as it is, and that kind of just fueled risk off sentiment, and we saw money flowing out of EM, and that certainly helped in the market a little bit lower.
Still on the local front, however, if you take a look at the likes of Massmart, as we spoke about that earnings statement, it's clearly indicative that just because we have a change in sentiment, particularly regarding, you know, Ramaphosa coming into power, doesn't necessarily translate into money that will all of a sudden go into retailers. So they're still going to suffer despite what some may see as a positive time in the country.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, positive sentiment helps to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And sure, everyone feeling more optimistic and feeling like, you know, perhaps things are going to be okay. You do, I suppose, you know, use some, you might go for a little bit extra discretionary spending, but it doesn't change the fact that, you know, we still have unemployment at incredibly high rates.
Yeah.
You look at the retailer specifically with regard to Massmart, it's also a very, very competitive industry in South Africa with a lot of foreign entrants coming in as well. And the whole shape of retail is changing as it is. So, you know, you look at the likes of Massmart and you've got to question, you know, how much of South African purchasing is now going to be made online. You've already seen the story play out in the US with the whole battle between Amazon and Massmart's parent, Walmart.
Yes,
and I mean, we saw Walmart reporting sales. I mean, obviously, Walmart's now moving aggressively into India, looking to try and get more of an online presence. But, you know, again, the growth in those two companies is clear. I mean, Amazon's growing at almost 40% a year, whereas Walmart's only growing at 4%. And you know, if you look at the retailers in South Africa, they've always traded on fairly extended earnings multiples. And, you know, we have seen that moderate to an extent, but you know, if you're in a high teen PE, if you're measuring it by PEG ratio, you should have your headline earnings growing in the high teens as well. So single digits is no good.
Yeah, into your commodity space, gold as well, heading higher above $1,300 a fine ounce as well. There, that international story with Trump is certainly the backdrop to that one, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, gold, we kind of see gold as a currency as well. So it's, you know, again, we also had FOMC this week as well, which, I think helped to settle the market's nerves that we wouldn't get an aggressive, rate hiking profile. And obviously gold is also, if you measure it in currency, it's a currency that has no yield. So if you have slightly lower expectations on yield on, say, US treasuries, that makes gold relatively more attractive than it was before the announcement. So that's certainly helping things, but gold remains a safe haven asset. So when you do get geopolitical tensions rising, when you get concerns, you do see a move into the likes of gold. And that certainly, as the announcement broke, I think gold spiked, was about $15 an ounce.
Yeah.
So definitely seeing the move there as well.
Yeah. That translated into the rand as well. Yes, it did hit 12.39, but it's now at 12.43, having hit around 12.50, 60, I think probably 12.70 odd at some point. Is it going to just remain within a particular bracket now? I think probably from 12.80 to around 12.30 or so. Are we expecting any major moves?
You tell me. it seems like a good bracket. I mean, you know, looking at currency movement, it's incredibly difficult to predict these things. And I mean, we went through a fairly strange patch where the rand seemed to stabilize around 12 rand and we had no volatility. Mm. And that was probably the most surprising thing that's happened on the currency so far. If you look at kind of the technicals, we have kind of broken that strengthening trend and we're starting to move higher. So it does seem like we're in a gradual little weakening channel, which, as you said, the levels that we're seeing is about probably the next high will be around 13 rand to the dollar, and 12.40, 12.35 seems to be the lows. You know, any lower than that, I think you've again got a change of trend and you might see a more significant strengthening.
Yeah.
But you know, you're going to have fundamental news backing that up. And as you say, I think from the administration's point of view, I know you guys are going to be talking to Pravin Gordhan later as well. I mean, I think we're making all the right noises, but you know, until we see some of the economic data changing, you know, it's going to be difficult to see what could potentially drive the currency much stronger than this level.
Yeah. Oil price as well. What is interesting for me with regards to it is particularly in yesterday's announcement by the Monetary Policy Committee, the South African Reserve Bank, they're assuming an oil price of $70 a barrel for 2018. Now, that's fine. That's just an average for the year. But already it's been sitting nearly at $80 a barrel for quite some time. It's probably going to hover around there for quite some time. So to assume that sort of a price, would that not mean that they perhaps really underestimating just how far it could go? Or is that perhaps a safe bet?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. So, I mean, this debate rages on. Everyone I speak to seems to either feel that the Reserve Bank is being too conservative,
sure,
or it's a great thing that it's conservative, because it's one of the institutions that really, you know, has helped to, I suppose, stabilize our credit rating, mm-hmm. and prevent a far worse economic situation. Looking at oil prices specifically, again, it's almost as difficult. I don't think it's quite as difficult, but it's almost as difficult to predict as currency. So if you listen to Bob Dudley, I think CEO of BP,
yes, yeah,
he sees oil actually falling all the way down to, I think it's between $50 and $65 a barrel.
Sure.
And he says that this really is going to come with the higher prices have moved up, the shale supply is coming online. Also, if OPEC does remove its freezes and start supplying more aggressively, you could quite easily see oil prices coming down again. And that's how he's positioning BP. So it's a difficult question, you know, looking at the short term with the geopolitical tensions, and especially around Iran, which is a big supplier to the market,
yeah,
a very different situation from Syria. It potentially, we see that there could quite easily be a short term spike to even up to $100 a barrel. I think anything more than that is going to be very, very extended. But longer term, you would expect a moderation. So Reserve Bank taking, you know, sort of a $70 average, it seems reasonable to me.
Yeah. Continuing with what the Reserve Bank said yesterday, we'll chat to Kevin Lings.
Right. He's actually on the line. He's the chief economist at StanLib. And if you're just tuning in, it's 17 minutes after six, and we're talking about the subcommittee and all. It was actually a unanimous decision to keep rates on hold, and they're saying that the risks to the consumer price inflation outlook have tilted to the upside. Kevin, thanks so much for your time. Since the MPC last met in March, there's a whole host of things that have changed. Perhaps take us through some of the standout ones, perhaps even including the pace of normalization by the Fed. That's one of the things that stuck out to me.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the Reserve Bank did highlight a number of factors that they're looking at, I think, a little bit more carefully, I guess. The one is obviously the higher oil price and what that is meaning for our petrol price. Remember, next month we're going to have in excess of 80 cents a litre increase in the petrol price. That comes on the back of two big increases in the previous month. So there's clearly some pressure from the fuel side. The other is obviously the rand has been quite volatile and generally under a bit of pressure. And the Reserve Bank is obviously attributing that to dollar strength, and clearly a little bit unsure about whether the dollar strength continues on. So that is, I would say, one of the factors they're looking at.
Mm.
In addition, you have got public sector wages and other wages that are going up around 7%. The Reserve Bank said they put 7% into their model over the next couple of years. And clearly there is some pressure there from wages that can push through to inflation, I guess, broadly.
Right.
The other interesting thing is that they put in 8% for the next increase from Eskom on electricity. And it could well be more than that, because obviously Eskom is looking for something like 30%. So there's some risk there. So when you look at all the different factors most of the factors that they mentioned, they have deteriorated and would suggest some upside risk to inflation. And that's essentially what the Reserve Bank concluded, that the inflation risk has changed. They didn't really change, interestingly enough, their forecast.
Yeah.
So it's not as if they're translating that into a significantly higher inflation outlook, but clearly enough has changed for them to be more concerned, And therefore, I think it was appropriate just to keep interest rates on hold while these developments unfold.
Right. Later tonight, we're all expecting a ratings announcement from S&P. What are your expectations?
So S&P last reviewed us, I think it was about the 24th of November last year. That was when they gave us the big downgrade. They took down both our domestic and international credit rating. So they're both firmly in junk status. So this is a review. There's some criticism of S&P that they didn't do what Moody's did. In other words, wait to see what the outcome of the ANC elective conference would be in December and then make a decision, which is effectively what Moody's did, and maybe they would have made a different decision. Now it feels that the downgrades were a little bit too excessive. Obviously, Standard & Poor's can't reverse that immediately, but I am expecting a better tone from them. Remember, they put out some growth updates for South Africa, and they are looking for around 2%, so they're looking for an improvement in SA growth this year and next year. And they actually one of the higher forecasts for South Africa's growth, so they've clearly become a little bit more positive on the country.
Right.
So I'm expecting that they'll leave the credit rating unchanged tonight, but there is a chance that they change the outlook statement and create a more positive feel to say that if we continue to reform the SOEs, in other words, change the boards, try and get them into better shape,
yeah,
and if we can lift the growth rate, then there's a possibility we could find ourselves looking at an upgrade down the line. But I think so I'm expecting the tone to be better, but not a material change in the ratings.
All right, that's Kevin Lengs, who's the chief economist at StanLib. We're a little late, but time to check in on traffic.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
7:23, a new board at SA Express, despite being grounded yesterday after the Civil Aviation Authority suspended the airline's operating permits, a new board at Danel, a new board at Transnet, and the confirmation of Eskom's new CEO, a major shakeup happening in state enterprises. Public Enterprises Minister Pravin Gordhan joining us on the line. Thank you so much for your time, Minister. Very quickly, are you aware of how long it may take to get SA Express back into the skies and what must be done for that to happen?
Well, good morning to you and your listeners. Well, yeah, the SA Express technical issues are actually related to, as we say in our statement, the malfeasance at SA Express over the last few years. So we have an intervention team that's in there for the last week, and we have a good understanding of what both the technical and other issues are. And I'm confident in the next fortnight or so, we'll be able to put together the minimum required for the airline to fly again.
Yeah.
But what is clear is that we need the new board to take charge of the airline. Secondly, we need to get permanent management in place. Thirdly, in line with the government's intentions, the merger process with SAA and Mango should commence as well, so that we can get better synergies from these airlines.
Yeah.
And I think this is a good shock to the system for us to all realize that these are the kinds of effects corrupt practices can end up with, and that this is something we need to avoid because airlines involve the safety
indeed
of members of the public.
Yeah. Talking about that merger with Mango and SA as well, how long could that process in itself take? And if you're removing duplications, would that not result in perhaps a reduction in workforce, which means cutting jobs?
Well, we don't know how long it'll take. But the sooner we get to it, the better. Mm. Some things are easier. For example, if we begin to rationalize routes and the type of aircraft used on different routes, that shouldn't take too much of time to actually do. But we'll have to look at the legal dimensions and other dimensions as well. On the staffing question, it's hard to say at the moment. I think the SAA chief executive did say that, and this applies to many of the SOEs, that our cost structure, let alone the revenue structure, is probably inordinate in many of these outputs. And at the same time, we've got to be very mindful of the unemployment situation in our country.
Yeah.
So hopefully we can find a balanced solution, and one which enables us to be cost-effective on the one hand, operationally efficient on the other hand, and a couple of months' time, at least we have some sanity prevailing in this environment.
Yeah. Despite the cleanup for now, of course, things are still operationally very difficult for a lot of the SOEs. Have you approximated how much you require financially in order to support, a few of these SMEs in the meantime?
In the SA Express case, we require a couple of hundred million. There's been discussions between our department and the Treasury in that regard that should be resolved fairly soon. And the reason we need this money is that, firstly, there's been drastic over-expenditure. As we said yesterday, payments to various firms that have been linked to malfeasance in one form or another without any services being rendered. Exceptional payments made in terms of parts to so-called middlemen and middlewomen. So we're losing money in that sort of way, rather than making sure that we operate cost-effectively. So, we do need spare parts, we do need tires, we need to repatriate engines that have been sent out for repairs. And if we had a few hundred million rands, we could actually get the airline off the ground again and get the technical aspects done, which will enable the operations to bring in revenue and hopefully start a virtuous cycle.
Yeah.
Minister, from the public enterprise's point of view, have you already started the processes of recovering stolen funds that we've seen disappearing from the coffers, or perhaps even compiling documents to submit to the State Capture Commission of Inquiry?
Well, firstly, we've stated the intent, as the President has as well. Secondly, at least we've stated in the public domain that people who have information about these matters should help us. And we are getting the early signals in terms of how to begin this process. But ultimately, it will involve our law enforcement agencies who have the legal instruments to do some of this work. But there's also civil litigation that we will explore as well. So at the moment, our focus is to get boards and management right. And as we do so, understand the extent of the malfeasance. And on the other hand, get some operational efficiencies going. And as the boards begin to settle down, part of their responsibility is to chase up the money as well.
Yeah. Minister, just as a final question, are you getting any resistance from some of these SOEs as you try to clean house?
I think we must all expect resistance, because those who've been beneficiaries of these extraction processes are not going to give up easily.
Yeah.
They depend on a completely new lifestyle as a result of the extra money that they've been getting and a level of extravagance that's unimaginable. Yeah, in many instances. So there will be some who will have a moment of conscience and own up to what they've been doing.
Yeah.
And as the commission starts its work, more and more of those might actually come forward. And on the other hand, there'll be those who believe that they can use gangster tactics to frighten off people who are investigating malfeasance of one sort or another. So I think the public needs to be aware that the show is not over, so to speak.
Yeah.
And the public needs to be, on the one hand, vigilant, and on the other hand, supportive of these measures, so that we can actually get rid of both the actual corruption that we see, but also the mindsets that lead to this problem.
Yeah. Minister, we greatly appreciate your time this morning. Public Enterprises Minister Pravin Gordhan joining us on the line as we chat about the changes he's making to South Africa's state-owned entities, and big changes there. It's just gone 7:31. A quick look at your news headlines.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
It's 7:32. So a very interesting company called Labashe Financial Services. So they've actually increased their stake in a company called Rainfin. And this is all to, you know, set the pace in establishing a black-owned firm. And we're joined by Warren Wheatley, who's the executive director at Labashe Financial Services. Warren, thanks so much for your time. I mean, let's talk about, you know, when you started increasing your pace in Rainfin and what the ultimate objective is.
Good morning, guys, and thanks for having me. So we've been steadily increasing our holding in Rainfin since about 2016. Mm-hmm. Ultimate objective is to get control of the platform so we can direct it with our objectives in mind.
Yeah.
Those being to open up capital markets to people who have been previously excluded. Mm. Our major aim is to, you know, allow quick, efficient access to capital to SMEs. Given that that's one of the major drivers of job creation in the country.
All right. You mentioned that you're seeing opportunities in South Africa and in the continent that are worth taking advantage of, where access to financial services and more specifically, as you mentioned, business funding is still a challenge for many consumers and entrepreneurs. What opportunities are those, particularly, yes, in the continent and in South Africa as well?
Well, our platform is looking to do two things primarily. Number one, accumulate capital from not your ordinary banks and other financial institutions. So we're looking to accumulate assets from institutional investors and retail investors and apply those to things that typically wouldn't. So a peer-to-peer lending platform takes money from a retail investor, as an example, and can deploy it to a businessman who is trying to start a spaza shop or open a mechanic store. So we are finding that people are struggling to or looking for different places to invest their money. Mm. And we helping them by directing it into the places where that capital is needed. And that applies in SA, but equally across Africa.
I was reading your the press statement, and you mentioned here, and I quote, "We further have learned, well, furthermore, we've learned a great deal from the development of Afrikaner capitalism that has resulted in financial services groups such as Rand Merchant Bank, Sanlam, and others." Tell me about that.
Well, we've got a great history of business builders in the country. Mm. And, you know, we've watched models, you know, from the Stellenbosch crowd, and how these great businesses like PSG, Capitec, mm-hmm. the First Rand Group have been built, and how they use influence in their investments to support their own platforms and grow their own platforms. And that's the model we take in. You know, we don't want to be portfolio investors. Any investment we look at, we like to have influence so we can direct procurement and strategy and, mm-hmm. and those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And that we've seen there's enough history on that to learn quite a bit from.
I think over the past couple of months, we've seen the theme or the topic around getting a state-owned bank increasingly get louder. Do you support that? And how do you see perhaps even opportunities between yourselves and a possible state-owned bank in the near future?
So you know, I don't think I can talk intelligently to the merits or demerits of a state-owned bank.
Mm-hmm.
What I do want to say is that we want to disrupt the typical banking model.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. It doesn't get money to entrepreneurs. It doesn't support small business. So we're looking for capital from unique and different sources so that we can apply it to the neglected areas of the market.
Mm.
But I think a state-owned bank could potentially work.
Yeah. All right. In terms of partnerships that you could see in the future between yourselves and those other parts, I don't know, other private companies or banks, in order to be able to fulfill your agenda in helping small businesses, which are those and where exactly could you be seeing that opportunity?
So I keep talking about accumulating capital from different sources. So we want to talk to sovereign funds who want to invest in the country, institutional investors, pension and provident funds, the PIC, other DFIs, all these institutions that have mm-hmm. large assets under management and need to deploy that into the capital markets. We believe very much in aggregation and partnering as opposed to dividing and conquering.
Yeah.
So we open to discussions with any like-minded business who want to see capital deployed more effectively and efficiently.
All right. That's Warren Wheatley, who's the executive director at Lubashe Financial Services, which is one of the businesses that's at the forefront of trying to establish a black-owned bank.
This is Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
A quick look at some other news-making headlines as well today. This is something that has perhaps come out yesterday, but I think it's still very keen and very good interest. Comair sort of set to end its contract with SAA Technical and has really put up Lufthansa Technical to help with its technical expertise. And so that discussion in itself has started to happen. Let's remember that it's just over 700 million rand, I think, that SAA Technical has made, and obviously that would have helped SA coffers in many ways, but that seems to be fading away, and a large bulk of that contract is going to end, meaning that the 700 million odd may come to dissipate because Comair is a very large consumer or client of SAA Technical. So it is really quite a big deal on that front.
There's one story that I saw in the Business Day, and it actually ties in quite nicely with the conversation we were having with the Public Enterprises Minister, particularly when it relates to the state capture inquiry. We have Raymond Zondo, who's heading up the inquiry, saying that the Commission's assessment is that it'll take 2 years to complete, and that is 6 months more than the time allocated in the terms of reference. And this was comments from the Commission Chairman, Deputy Chief Justice Raymond Zondo. So very interesting as to, you know, how all of this will play out, and considering that Minister Pravin Gordhan is trying to recoup some of the monies that were stolen as part of what was going on when it comes to state capture.
Yeah, I think that state capture conversation will continue for quite some time, because there's so much to actually do in there as well. But it has gone 20 minutes to 8 o'clock. Let's get a quick look at your traffic.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
13 minutes to the top of the hour. I spoke to Dr. Dolph Deroos, who is a New York Times and Wall Street's Journal best-selling author. And he's also included in his body of work where he talks about real estate riches, part of the Rich Dad, Poor Dad series. And I had a conversation with him about how he believes one can successfully invest in property and why he believes South Africa's real estate market is a great investment destination.
Oh, gosh, you know, I've been told by my parents over and over again that in order to do well in life, you have to study hard and get a degree. And yet when I looked around me at the people with the degrees, it occurred to me that they weren't uniformly wealthy. So I wanted to know, what is it that the wealthy have in common? And to keep the story short, I made this survey, and the only thing I could find that they had in common is that they tended either to make their money or hold their wealth in real estate. And I thought, if that's the only thing they have in common, I can do that. Mm. That's really why I got into it. And I still believe it is the best investment for people to get into.
Was it residential or commercial at the time? Because I find people tend to say residential is more easier to get into. And then as you become a sophisticated investor, you start moving into commercial.
That is absolutely true. I certainly started with residential. And the reason why it's easier is we can all understand residential. If you look at a house and there's no roof there or no front door, we'll all notice it. But for most of us, when we first look at a commercial property, we're not sure what we should be looking for. And also the numbers tend to be bigger. So yes, most people start with residential, but as they learn more, they realize there are some advantages of commercial that make it exceedingly, you know, interesting for the investor.
Right. When it comes to, you know, properties' advantages and disadvantages in this current environment or in this current global environment, how are you seeing the property market at this point?
And I still see it as far more stable than the stock market or share market, because which stocks we should buy, should it be energy stocks or high tech or food production or oil? It's still very volatile, whereas real estate tends to be much slower to change. And you can follow those trends. A city that has been faster growing than another city tends to stay that way for years at a time, whereas other investments tend to be more volatile. They'll change which one is doing better. So I still believe with a passion that for most people, buying a house is a far better investment than buying gold or buying stocks or buying diamonds or investing in emu farms or all the other fads that have come and gone. And sort of proof of that is when people retire, almost without exception, their biggest asset is their home. It's not some fancy vintage car that they thought would rise in value a lot or grandfather's stamp collection. It's their home, and you'll hear them say, if only we bought a second home, we would now be almost twice as well off.
I've done an interview with Robert Kiyosaki, and we've spoken on numerous aspects when it comes to investing. And the one thing he constantly talks about is how to invest using other people's money outside of your own. In the property game, is it that easy as just using someone else's money to become wealthier?
Whenever you go around the world, you see banks are advertising that if you want to buy real estate, come and see us. We'll lend you the money to buy the property. Lend in the form of a mortgage, of course. Whereas they don't say that when it comes to you investing in diamonds or all those other investments. You'll never hear a bank say, do you want to buy shares? Come and see us. We'll give you 70 or 80% of the value. No, it's only on real estate, only on property, which tells you two things about property. Firstly, it's still a very stable investment because banks only lend on stable investments. And secondly, you don't even need all the money to buy the property. So the banks might give you 70% and you'll say, well, I still need another 30%. Well, there are many ways of getting the 30%. Maybe the seller will consider leaving some money and it's called seller finance. Or maybe you can get a second mortgage from another bank.
In your article titled Change Your Financial Future by Investing in Real Estate, you mentioned that South Africa is well positioned as a real estate investment destination. Outside of South Africa, are there any other countries that you're looking at that could be potential investment destinations in the real estate space?
Yes, the other country that I think is really good as an investment destination is the United States. And it's for a number of reasons. The cost of building there is still significantly lower than many other Western nations. And we have returns that are far healthier than in many other countries. So I, you know, highly recommend people who are looking at diversifying internationally to consider the United States. And it's not always been number one on my list. Sometimes I've taken investors to Australia or parts of Asia. But right now, the way economies are going, I think the U.S. is certainly a destination that has to be considered.
That's Dr. Dolph de Roos talking to us about investing successfully in property.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Arensa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
13 minutes to the top of the hour. Very important and very significant to get as much infrastructure and development into South Africa, but also very key to get investment into the country. And one such company that looks to be making very, very big investment into a plant in South Africa, particularly in KZN, is Mahindra, the vehicle company. They've set to put out an assembly plant. On the line for us now is Rajesh Gupta, the CEO of Mahindra South Africa. Mr. Rajesh, thank you so much for your time. How much is the investment into the assembly plant and into the country overall, just based on this announcement?
Thank you very much, and good morning to all the listeners of the radio channel. So we are today going to open up our assembly plant in South Africa, where we are putting up a contract manufacturing assembly through our partner, AIH Logistics. The cumulative investment is going to start with 10 million ZAR. And we are thinking about, you know, increasing our localization and then later on using this as a facility to support export from South Africa to other countries in the Africa continent.
Yeah. Government has also been making requests regarding the manufacture of vehicles in the country, particularly to other manufacturers of vehicles. Are you in any sort of discussion with government as to, you know, how you can be part of that future progress with regards to job creation? And how big a future do you see for Mahindra in South Africa?
Mahindra in South Africa is now a 14-year-old company. We are among the 5 fastest growing OEM in the auto industry space. And we are getting a very good support from government, and we are actually partnering government in terms of supporting the aspect of investment as well as, you know, the employment and the skills that we want to nurture over here. The intention is from the point of view that the local employees that we have now taken in, and we are working with them in terms of developing their skills. How do we soon get into a situation by increasing localization of the component? Because once we get into that mode, the allied industries and the component manufacturers will also be able to increase employment. So we are taking it step by step. The first step is to set up this assembly plant. The second is to increase localization. And third step is to take this as a manufacturing hub for us and support the export for the rest of the countries and continent.
How many jobs are you going to create through this plant alone?
As of now, we have already created 25 jobs. There are these additional jobs. Just 6 weeks back, these guys were not having any employment. Now they are employed and working with us. And we intend to get into a situation where the numbers that we are doing right now, if they increase, then we get into the second shift of this assembly line, and that will add to the another set of employees that will join us.
Yeah. How are you working around the steel tariffs issue? Because that seems to have been an issue globally. But of course, with South Africa now facing a few things outskirts, is the fact that we no longer have to sort of put out as much exports of steel and the like. Does that bear fruit really well for Mahindra in the South African context? And of course, the price of precious metals?
So, this is a good question to look upon and, you know, reflect upon. But if you speak from the point of view of Mahindra and the way we are seeing South Africa, the first thing is that, you know, we wanted to develop this as our second home. The interesting aspect about South Africa is that the economy is now reviving, and it's very soon going to, you know, boom. And, you know, we are expecting that, you know, first is to feed the domestic demand. But when it comes to seeing a role of South Africa for the rest of the continent, I think there are already many countries where we are already aligned, and if we can get to that level, I think that those places which will, you know, sooner or later will be sorted out. So I am sure that the directions that government is taking up will support this entire equation for South Africa for the remaining continent. So I think these issues will be handled effectively as we move forward.
Mr. Rajesh Gupta, the CEO of Mahindra South Africa, big investment into a plant in KZN in particular, creating jobs and investing in the future of South Africa with regards to its economy as well. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
This is Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
Time to look at investing in classic cars. I mean, thousands of car aficionados, as we've mentioned earlier in the intro, often travel extensively to events such as the NISA Motor Show, for instance, to view some of the most, head-turning heritage vintage cars in the country. And many hope one day to own one of these iconic vehicles. And to talk about whether classic cars are a good investment or not, I'm joined on the line by Leon Strumpfer, who is the portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth. Leon, thanks so much for your time this morning. Let's talk about the classic car market, and how viable is it, particularly in South Africa?
Good morning, Nastasia. It's a great market. I think it's something that has to be considered. You know, luxury goods and alternative asset classes have been part of high net worth and ultra high net worth individuals' portfolios for centuries. So I don't know why the average person can't look at it as a alternative investment sort of asset class. And I think that's why we're looking at it carefully, is because the returns have been great. They've almost been too good. And it's a good diversifier.
Right. For those who can't afford them, because, I mean, they come at such really steep prices, is there a way to invest in a car as you would perhaps timeshare on a certain piece of property, for instance?
Okay, not exactly, but I don't think they're so far out of reach.
Mm-hmm.
I think the perception is everyone thinks that classic cars, you're going to go and drop R1 million or R2 million,
yeah,
and then you have to have this vehicle for the next 10 years, and then you only realize your investment. I think for the collectors that are serious about it, there's a lot that you have to take into account. You have to basically purchase real estate to house these vehicles.
Mm.
You have to maintain these vehicles. So the parts cost money. But if you're an individual that wants to start out and get into the classic car market, it's just homework.
Yeah.
So you want to go and look and scout the web and get as many opinions as you can. Go to car shows, speak to individuals. And obviously, it's something that you will pursue if you are interested in it. So you mustn't go and buy a vehicle that you don't like looking at or don't like driving, because then I think it's irrelevant in doing this. So firstly, buy a vehicle that you like, that looks wise. Secondly, you know, low production numbers are great. Original condition is good. Low kilometers or mileage. So that kind of stuff is very important. And there are, look, our market is very limited because of our steep import tariffs. So it just hasn't made sense in the past to import a vehicle from the 80s and pay double the price of the vehicle. So all those vehicles that could have been in our country haven't been yet because of steep import tariffs.
All right. Are there popular models that people go after, perhaps those that came from a certain, maybe the 60s, or they were created by a certain car maker?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, it is quite limited because there are probably marques, and a marque is a sort of a brand of car.
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely marques that haven't been prevalent in our country for any particular reason. But Mercedes-Benz, great marque, you can find them quite easily in South Africa, and there's very good series within that marque that are appreciating dramatically in price, like your SL models back from the, you know, the pagodas from the 60s.
Mm.
And then there's a few that are really sort of, you'll call them international investment items, like your 300 SLs, which are going for, I mean, 10 million plus at this moment in time. So, yeah, there's a lot of, I would say Porsche is an excellent mark to look at.
Mm.
They are appreciating in value dramatically. Ferrari, if you can get your hands on one, I mean, that's the iconic mark, Ferrari. So if you're a player that can, you know, part with five or 10 million rand on a high net worth, a very expensive vehicle and have it appreciate in value, I mean, that would definitely be the mark I would be looking at. But if you were a person coming into the space, I would start looking at your European brands, or your European marks, like your Alphas, like your Austin Healeys, like your Triumphs.
Mm.
Even your Japanese vehicles are also beautiful. You know, from the 70s, your Mazdas, your Datsuns, and those kind. But certain models within the mark.
Right.
You want to have, you know, vehicles that weren't produced in mass.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. But saying that, you know, there were a million Mustangs that were produced. Over a million Mustangs. Yet Mustangs are appreciating in value dramatically because there are so few in this country. Yeah.
All right. That's Leon Stramfer, who is a portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, talking to us about investing in classic cars and some really good names out there. Arabile, do you have $300 million that I could borrow?
Let's just say, if I did, I'm not sure I'd be in studio right now. Just putting it out there.
I was just saying, what's $300 million between? two friends, eh?
It's a little bit of a loan, isn't it? Yeah. Look, I don't, but, you know, the classic car thing, I think I haven't really gone into. I'm not the biggest car fan, but I do find it quite interesting. I know a few people who would really get into it quite heavy as well. And even one of our guests, Wayne McCurry, that we speak to from time to time,
yes,
has quite a big Jaguar collection as well. So that's quite interesting. I wanted to just touch very, very quickly before we end the show off. The Reserve Bank, you know, in that MPC announcement yesterday, I think was very loaded. And I don't think we you know, there's enough really said about it, but they think that the first quarter is going to see negative growth. And I think that in itself is quite telling that, you know, yes, fine, we may see Ramaphosa come into power, but it doesn't necessarily mean that things are just going to miraculously change for South Africa's economy. And I think it's about time that things hit the road really, really hard. The changes that the likes of Minister Pravin Gordhan make with regards to SOEs as well, very, very key, very, very important. And it's about doing the hard work now in order to get South Africa to change.
All right, that's it from us. We're back next week, Monday, between 7 and 8 a.m. Great show, great being with you. Goodbye from me.
Yeah, enjoy your weekend.